and Israel must be held accountable. Thank you.
That was Irene Khan, Special Rapporteur on the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, speaking at the press conference held at the United Nations office in Geneva on September 15, 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth. Listening to KBOO Portland.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to conventions, Nate and James share what makes the hobby so vibrant through banter and interviews with local members of the hobby game scene. And if we can inspire a few listeners to join us around the table, all the better. More people to play with. Winner's Bias. You don't have to win to have fun, but it doesn't hurt. The first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Into a crisis.
Hello, you're listening to Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we're talking with John Walker about an upcoming event here in Portland. John Walker is here to talk to us about this forum that's coming up and help talk about what's going on in Cuba. So John, welcome to Radio Zine on KBOO.
Thank you, Emma. Good to be here. Good to be with you.
Thanks. So John, first of all, can you share with us the details of this forum that's going to be coming up in October?
Okay, it's taking place in Portland on Saturday, October the 4th at 2 p.m. The venue will be the Albina Library, Room 1A, which is on 205 Northeast Russell Street, downtown Portland. We're encouraging local people to come and be there in person, but we're also going to be streaming it on Zoom. So for and some national audience, so people can register through tinyurl.com YF6F3RJY.
Thanks. So, John, can you tell me a little bit about what's going to be discussed at this forum?
Three themes. First of all, the introductory speaker, Dr. Samira Adri, who is a US physician who was trained in Cuba at the Latin American Medical School. She will talk about Cuban healthcare, its achievements, and introduce what can the US learn from Cuban healthcare. The second speaker, Dr. Michael Huntington, who is a retired Oregon physician, lives in Corvallis. He's been a long-term campaigner for healthcare for all in the US, national health program, and he will talk, including in Oregon. So he will talk more specifically about what the US, the campaigning in US, can learn from Cuba and apply for, hopefully one day, not too far in the future, a national US healthcare plan. And then I will talk about what's happening in Cuba, how this model health service is under attack from the US government, as it's been for many years, but particularly now under Trump, to try and destroy this example, because it provides a political threat to the US, so that Cuba has got abundance of skilled health workers, but is really short of the things they need, the medicines, the supplies, the equipment. So those are the three themes, and then we'll talk for maybe 40 minutes between us, and then it's open for questions.
Great, thanks. And again, when is that forum going to be, and where is it at?
Saturday, October the 4th at 2 p.m. at the Albina Library, Room 1A, 205 Northeast Russell Street, Portland 97205.
Thanks. So the part that you're really familiar with in the story is how the U.S., the actions of the U.S. have been damaging to Cuba and to the Cuban healthcare system. Can you tell me a little bit more about what's going on with that?
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. has an economic blockade of Cuba ever since 1960. But in recent years, it's become more extreme, especially under Trump, but also to some extent under the Biden administration as well. So one of the things Trump did was to put Cuba on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. No evidence, just said, I'm deciding you're a state sponsor of terrorism, as Trump does in all these things. And what that means is that if the Cuban Health Service wants to, well, I'll give you a concrete example. The Cuban Health Service needs heart pacemakers. They can't produce them themselves. Most of the companies that produce them are US, so they can't buy them from the US. But there are some companies in Europe that do sell, do provide them, and would in theory sell to Cuba. But because Cuba is listed as a sponsor of terrorism, when Cuba tries to pay, the bank, the European bank, refuses to accept the payment, because this is terrorism. This is terrorist slush money, basically, they're saying. And the bank knows that if they accept that money, they could face massive fines from the US government for just doing an ordinary transaction of a government health service buying pacemakers. So that's why in the US and in Europe, we've been campaigning recently to raise funds so that we purchase the pacemakers in Europe and they are sent to Cuba. That's one example, but it's extreme now that the blockade means the Cuban government is short of money. But even when they have the money, they're often not allowed to spend it because of this extreme measures.
How do Cuban doctors and nurses cope with the day-to-day reality of shortages and restrictions?
It's very hard. It's an extreme version now, but they've been doing this for years. So they're very skilled at diagnosis, which means that in this country, if you think you might be having a heart attack, you go to the hospital, they do all kinds of tests and then umpting things out and then tell you what you've got. In Cuba, the doctors have to diagnose. So if you're going to have one test, you're going to have one test, because they've already got a pretty good idea what's wrong. And then it's partly using kind of alternative medicine, things like acupuncture, herbal remedies. They've developed this quite a lot. It's also recognizing that some things don't require drugs. They maybe require physiotherapy. They maybe require counseling. It's as far as possible trying to use non-drug solutions wherever they can, like acupuncture for pain control, for instance.
How do Cubans perceive their healthcare system today, given both its achievements and struggles under sanctions?
I think it's very hard. I mean, people are very proud of the healthcare service. They were immensely proud of it during the COVID pandemic, where it largely sheltered Cubans from the worst effects of the pandemic. And Cuba, uniquely amongst countries of the global south, produced their own vaccines against COVID, as effective as anything Pfizer and Moderna can produce. But now people realize there's all kinds of shortages. So there's real suffering going on, because all the things I told you about how Cuban doctors can substitute, but they can't do that for everything. Some things require the medicines, or they require, I mean, the pacemaker example. There are people who, thanks to the pacemakers we've sent, I've now had them inserted for free, but there were people who could have been living a normal life outside, but had to be hospitalized and kept in a hospital and kept alive artificially until the pacemaker arrived. So that's real suffering for the individual. It's suffering for the families who have to deal with that. So this is a terrible situation. They're dealing with it as creatively as they can, but they need us to help, and they need us to get this blockade and this designation of state-sponsored terrorism lifted.
Looking ahead, what changes would you like to see either in U.S. policy or within Cuba itself that could improve healthcare outcomes for the Cuban people?
Well, the changes need to come in the U.S. end. Cuba's shown it's got an excellent health service, and they're always working to improve it. They don't claim to be perfect, but the changes need to come at this end. So, yes, I mean, ideally, we want the whole policy of aggression and economic blockade lifted. Under Obama in his last 2 years, some steps were taken towards that. Nothing like enough, but some steps. And that was a sign of real hope in the people, I suppose, for the Cuban people, that there could be an end to this. Getting the state sponsor of terrorism designation lifted, that can be done by Trump with a stroke of his pen. I mean, do I expect it to happen under Trump? No, but that could be done. It doesn't require Congress. The blockade needs to be lifted by Congress because it's enshrined in law. But really, any measures that ease the pressure. One other thing I haven't yet talked about is that one of the way Cuba earns money to buy things for its health service is that it has doctors in abundance. So those doctors have been working around the world in medical brigades, providing emergency care, providing primary care in communities, rural communities where there's no doctor. Cuban doctors working in 50 countries around the world at the moment. And the US is trying to stop that. The US is basically been threatening the recipient countries, many of them Caribbean islands, so small countries, not strong economies, threatening that if you don't send these Cuban doctors home, we're going to sanction you. And one or two have caved in, but most so far are actually saying our people need these Cuban doctors. So just to get the US to stop, it's coming through the State Department, Marco Rubio, to get them to stop pressurizing other countries to and allow Cuban doctors to work and save lives elsewhere in the world, that benefits those countries, their people, but it benefits the Cuban people because of the earnings that are generated.
That's great. I mean, despite the sanctions, Cuba has sent doctors abroad for international solidarity missions. It sounds like this is played a really tremendous role in shaping global perceptions of Cuban medicine. How, I mean, what are some of the things that the United States doesn't see about Cuba that the rest of the world sees really clearly?
It doesn't see because it doesn't want to see, at least the government of this country doesn't want to see, that Cuba recognizes that the world has to work together, that I haven't talked about global warming, but there is no local solution to global warming. Cuba is Caribbean island, they know that, in the hurricane zone. There has to be international solutions. And when there's a global pandemic there, the world has to work together. One example I hadn't given yet, but I will do now, was when there was the Ebola pandemic, Ebola out crisis in West Africa a few years ago, about 10 years ago. This could potentially have been a disastrous pandemic worldwide. It was contained. It was primarily contained by Cuban medical brigades. The US under Obama did some things. They built a hospital. Okay, maybe a hospital was needed to be built, but Cuba supplied the healthcare, the specialists. And Ebola was contained and ultimately defeated in West Africa, and the rest of the world was saved. That's one example. I mean, Cuba know, the peoples of many world know that, many peoples of the world know that we have to work together for a better future for the planet.
Well, thank you. Tell us one more time about the event that's coming up. We've been talking with John Walker here on Radio Zine, and in just a moment we're going to have on Michael Huntington to talk to us. Michael is also going to be a presenter at this event. So, John, when is this happening again, and where?
Saturday, October the 4th at 2 p.m. It lasts for about an hour and a half. At Albina Library, Room 1A, 205 Northeast Russell Street, Portland, 97205.
Great, thanks. So, John, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Zine. And next up, we're going to have Michael Huntington.
Okay, good to be with you, Emma.
Okay, we're back for the second half of Radio Zine. We're talking with Mike Huntington, who's another panelist on the Cuban healthcare discussion that's going to be happening at the Albina Library. Mike, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Emma. Glad to be here. So my assignment is to extract what we saw in Cuba with their healthcare system and see what part of that we can use in our own country. Obviously, it's going to be only partials because of the culture, vast difference in our cultures. But there are local delivery of care ideas that we could use. So that's my assignment.
Thanks. So what are some of the successes that Cuba's had in healthcare? I mean, does everybody in Cuba have a doctor, for instance?
Yes. So from almost no access to healthcare, now every Cuban has access to healthcare. There's one family practice doctor and a nurse for every anywhere from 700 to 1400 people. And that usually constitutes about five or six city blocks. Can you imagine that, having a doctor for your neighborhood? And the doctor and the nurse live in the neighborhood in the same kind of housing, which is very modest, as you might imagine. And they make rounds of their neighborhood at least twice a year. So they know all the members of that neighborhood, their health status, the situation in their homes that might need correcting to improve their health. So that's just absolutely remarkable, especially under the handicaps that this country has placed upon them with the embargo. They prefer to call it a blockade since 1960.
What about vaccines? I mean, here in the United States, the CDC the CDC under Kennedy's leadership just told families not to vaccinate their children. What's the situation with vaccines in Cuba?
The situation there is very consistent with the culture of we're all in this together. And so if you refuse to get a vaccine, which they have shown were safe, the incidence of autism, for example, is not higher in Cuba than the United States. And even in spite of the blockade, they were very inventive and developed their own vaccines. And they had 99% of the Cuban population vaccinated early in the pandemic. And their incidence of COVID was very low, while millions of our people were dying, or thousands, hundreds of thousands. They kept their morbidity and mortality rate very low. So yes, they actually offered their vaccine to the United States early in the pandemic, but of course we were too proud and we refused.
It sounds like Cuba has a resilient healthcare system. Can you talk just a little bit about how Cuba educates its doctors?
Yes, that was one of the main goals of Che Guevara, is to establish medical schools because they had so few physicians at the start of the end of the revolution. So I think there's now, 40 medical schools, and they train and graduate 10,000 students and become doctors every year. Many of them stay in Cuba, and this is free, but they also train students from every place in the world, excuse me, with a stipulation that those students will go back to their countries to provide care. And that's true for the United States as well. One of our friends here in Corvallis just returned from Cuba a week or two ago, and she spoke with one of 25 U.S. students who are there in training, and those poor students have to come back to this system in the United States to practice as part of their agreement.
So shifting the tone just a little bit, when did U.S. sanctions against Cuba begin to affect Cuba's healthcare system? I mean, it must have happened right away, huh?
Yeah, right away, because they were so poor and they needed medical supplies, pharmaceuticals. They needed infrastructure, power plants. And of course, the U.S., not only was the U.S. not supplying them, but the U.S. was pressuring other countries not to supply them. So, of course, we drove Cuba into the hands of our, quote, enemies. Russia. And so Cuba and Russia had economic agreements until the fall of the Iron Curtain in the mid-80s, late 80s. And that devastated Cuba's economy, but they got through it. And now we're ratcheting up the blockade more now, and so we're driving Cuba into the hands of China. They're making agreements to do research on medications and so forth. So it's very self-defeating what we're doing there.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that doctors play in the community? I mean, here in the United States, doctors get paid a lot of money. I mean, they go to medical school, and I know it's really hard work. And then they get really well compensated. So, you know, they've got really nice jobs. They get paid a lot of money. They live in really nice communities. I mean, and some doctors make, you know, just tons of money. I mean, there's so much money that goes into medicine in the United States. What is this situation like for doctors in Cuba? I mean, do they get paid a lot of money for being doctors?
No. We were told that the average income for a family practice doctor was $12,000 a year. And yet, the lady we talked with, Barbara Marino, in Havana, she was in her probably mid-60s. She had this serene look She herself was disabled. She had a little crutch that she used, but a serene look of being satisfied with life. She does get her housing free. She does have her health care free. She has income, retirement income when she retires. And that's just sort of a statement of why young people go into medicine in Cuba. They want to help people. It's not income by any means.
Yeah. So being a doctor isn't necessarily more elevated than being any other kind of worker within the culture?
No. No, it's very egalitarian. Yeah. The dress that is just like everybody else that they see. Those clinics are open 24 hours a day. If the doctor or nurse are gone, there's a sign on the front door that says which neighborhood, closest neighborhood, has a doctor or nurse that can see them. Even the researchers, the vaccine researchers that spoke to us, wore a t-shirt, unassuming, no airs about him. But he was a scientist.
Does that mean that medical care and science isn't as good in Cuba as it is in the United States?
Not at all, just the opposite. Excuse me. High quality care. Their outcomes are better than ours. Their longevity, 79 years versus 76 years in our country. The blockade does affect their total outcomes, because they can't get the medicines or the parts to keep up their medical facilities. In spite of all that, their outcomes are better than ours.
So when people think about Cuba as a communist country, I think that a lot of people imagine something sort of like East Germany right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, kind of like this Stasi society that's really cold and, you know, kind of gray. I mean, what is Cuba really like?
Very Caribbean, very welcoming. The people we saw were friendly, interested in us. They had modern art. There seemed to be no restriction on the kind of art or music that people had. We saw no one that appeared to be homeless. I'm sure there are some, but when we had free range to travel where we wanted to, we were not sort of funneled into a showcase version of Cuba. I think that's the way to describe it. My friend Marisabel Gouverneur, who will be attending this meeting on October 4th with me, from Venezuela, but worked with Cuban doctors all over the world. She was an international midwife. And she felt the doctors trained in Cuba were very high quality and very empathetic, very sympathetic doctors. So just another way to show the quality of healthcare that Cuba has produced.
What about racism? I mean, is Cuba has a pretty diverse society. I mean, is racism a big issue in Cuba?
Very invisible, if it is. You're not black, you're not white. There's all various shades of people. You're Cuban. When they're feeling, and you can absorb it as you talk with groups of them, is that they care for each other, and they all feel as though they're on a level playing field. Not one person's better than another. Now, we did not get to talk with the communist leaders, and I'm very sure there's a hierarchy there, but not a racial hierarchy.
Great. Well, Mike, is there anything that we haven't talked about today about the panel discussion that's happening at the Albina Library that you'd like to make sure to mention?
Well, just that even though this country, because of its corporate structure and sort of, I would say, cowboy attitude, me first, we can't duplicate what Cuba has done. We can certainly borrow ideas. And just like, what do we say, all politics are local, all healthcare is local, and we can use some of their ideas in our counties, for example, to expand our county health departments, to work them more closely with primary care doctors, train enough doctors so that they can actually make house calls again. This is an important part of what the Cuban system does. We just need to be open to good ideas, and they have lots of good ideas.
Well, great. Thank you. We've been talking with Mike Huntington, and earlier we talked with John Waller about Cuban's national health care system and what the U.S. has to learn from it. That's a public forum that's going to be on Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m. at the Albina Library. Mike, thanks for joining us on Radio Zine today on KBOO.
You're welcome, Emma. Glad to take part in this.
Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.